And I'm gonna talk about this project we just published. In the publication, we gave it a more like geo-regulation perspective, but since we are this workshop about basically development and form and growth, I will go more into the development inspiration of the project. So, again, we have already seen this movie many different times in the past weeks. These are Drosophila embryo. These are the early stages of development of the Drosophila embryo. And what happens is we have this layer of cells arranged in a football shape, American football shape, and they divide more or less synchronously, and then at some point they stop. I mean, the movie stops, but the cells stop dividing too. And most of the things we have heard so far here focused on the next part of development, which is like gastrulation and more like mechanical things going on. And it seems like from a mechanical perspective, this part here will be, I don't want to underestimate it, but probably more boring. But anyway, I'm working in this in this stage of development. However, I'm not looking at mechanics, but more on at how genes are regulated. And while here seems that everything is homogeneous and no much is going on, if we look at gene expression, we see that at this stage, cells already know what's going to be. What are they going to be? So patterns of gene expression have already been formed, and the initial structure of that will end up giving rise to the embryo is already being patterned. So this shiny rotating embryo, I'm showing you patterns of gene expression of different genes. And this embryo is obtained from in situs made on different embryos and then averaged to create this atlas, or like this average embryo. And this is the kind of data we collect in the lab. So this is very shiny, but I'm not looking at these expression patterns. I'm going some steps backward and looking at ECOID and S5 again. So this is the ECOID gradient we have heard of already. So it's highly expressed in the anterior and decays more or less exponentially towards posterior. And ECOID, its main target in early development is this gene called Hunchback that is highly expressed in the anterior part. There's this sharp boundary in the middle of the embryo, and there's almost no expression in the back. So if we look at this region here, you see that the Hunchback profile has this shape. The way we usually look at this, if ECOID is controlling Hunchback, we usually plot this more in an input-output form, so how ECOID concentration affects Hunchback expression. And the way, so this is puzzling. So we don't know how the regulatory DNA is reading this smooth gradient to give rise to this sharp transition. And
can I ask a quick question? I probably should know this data, but is that really true that it plateaus? Like if you add in more copies of ECOID, can you push the Hunchback level higher?
If you add more copies of ECOID, you mean this goes up?
Yeah, is that, I'm just wondering on this diagram if that plateau at the higher ECOID concentration, if that's really true. Like
yeah,
if you put in more copies. Like if you put in more copies of ECOID, can you drive even more Hunchback than what's at that plateau?
I'm not sure about that. I know you move the boundary. Right. I think you don't go higher.
Okay.
I know if you start removing sites, you go lower.
I think that's right. I don't think you can add more copies of ECOID and you'll push Hunchback further into the posterior, but you won't raise the level.
Okay.
So yeah, and this is related to what I'm going to talk about. So this is the regulatory region of Hunchback, or at least one of the Hunchback enhancers, which is the one that gives rise to this shape here. It's believed to have six, seven, eight sites. It depends on how you look at it. So it's not. It's also difficult to identify sites. And so the common hypothesis to explain this shape here is that first, transition factors bind at equilibrium to the binding sites, and then they have this perverse cooperativity, so they help each other to bind there, and they drive this type of expression. And this is motivated by the fact that this shape fits well to a Hill function, which has this shape, and the Hill coefficient is 5-ish, 5 plus minus 1, I would say. And this is believed to be related directly to the number of binding sites involved. However, we know that Hill functions have no real biochemical meaning, so they are just phenomenologically inspired equations. And so, going some steps back, this way of using the modeling is basically, we have some data, we fit it to a model, and then from the model we extract some biochemical mechanism and we use it to explain what's going on. And leaving aside the fact that Hill functions are not real biochemical explanations of what's going on, the fact that you can fit something to something doesn't mean that that model explains what's going on. You might be able to fit it to something else. So our approach is sort of different. What we have done is, of course, we have some hypotheses in the field inspired by this previous approach, and we have taken those hypotheses and we have built a model. And then from that model, which is not a Hill function, it's something a little bit different, we can ask whether the model is able to explain the data. And so I think this is a different role for how to model, and it's more, let's say, experiments are more theory driven than just feeding at the end of the paper something to the model. So, okay, let's build a model. The first hypothesis is, of course, that transcription factors binding to DNA are what are regulating transcription. So, let's build a three site example. So, if we have three binding sites, a transcription factor can bind to either of the sites with, in principle, affinity A1, and then a K of B1. And then the same thing can be said for the other sites. Then we can keep building the graph so more sites can be added. In principle, we can calculate the probability of each of these states here. However, there's another assumption, which is that transcription factors bind at thermodynamic equilibrium, and that imposes some constraints on this graph. So basically, by imposing detailed balance, we have to satisfy first reversibility, so these fluxes have to be equilibrated, and so we can, instead of talking of A and B, we can just talk about a affinity constant K1, and then there's also the cycle condition, which means that the product of the rates going this way on each cycle in the graph has to be equilibrated with the flux. So after doing this algebra, of course we can show our graph has no forward and reverse reactions anymore because everything is equilibrated, and the state probability for each of these microstates can be written down in terms of this case here, and then this big omega, and of course, transcription factor constraint. And I'm going to tell you about this big omega. So, the big omega is what we call the cooperativity. And to give you an intuition of what it means, so it's of course a vector, so there are different cooperativities in the system. And we have basically two types of cooperativities. This first type where we have this guy binding here. If my influence, the affinity of this other one, which in principle will be binding with affinity K2, but the fact that this guy is here is scaling this K2 affinity, so it's turning this affinity, so it's basically scaling the affinity by omega 2 when free is bound. And they don't have to be consecutive sites, they can be separated, and we will have the same thing. And in this case, it will be K1 omega 1 when free is bound. And this can be extended to states where you have more sites occupied. So in this case, you have K1 scaled by omega 1 when 2 and 3 are bound. And in this extreme case, same thing, all these guys are helping this guy bind, or preventing the bind, by scaling this affinity by this omega. So these are two types of coproductivities. This is what we usually call the privileged coproductivity, which is just one-to-one interaction. And this is what we call the higher order coproductivities, and are caused by many transitive factors helping an extra transitive factor to bind. And where do these guys come from? So, of course, the privileged coproductivity can be explained by protein-protein interaction, and it doesn't have to be, so the sites don't have to be consecutive, they can be close together by just DNA looping or something like that. And also in eukaryotes, we know that there are other factors influencing transcription, like big molecules that bind to transcription factors and create these huge complexes. So we can imagine a configuration like this one here, where these three guys have recruited these two big molecules and they help the binding of the other one. And again, also in eukaryotes, we have most of the genome is wrapped around histones, so it's forming nucleosomes, and these nucleosomes are creating binding sites, so we can imagine this pioneer transcription factor binding here and somehow displacing a nucleosome and opening up other sites. So these coproductivities are just mathematical entities that are not trying to describe any particular mechanism, but they account for many different options. Okay, so I told you we can calculate the probability of each of these states. But at some point, if we want to have an equation for transcription, basically, we need to make some assumptions about which of these microstates is going to be driving transcription.
One question, what's the direct evidence we have for all this happening in equilibrium? Is that a single experiment?
There's not. And we are doing it because it's way easier. Say.
Well, if they start...
No, like modeling things at equilibrium is way easier.
But there's no reason to think of it.
So what I have seen is, if you have pure experimental papers, they always mention that there are many things going on that happen away from equilibrium. But then when you take one step to the theory side and they try to model it, they always assume it's at equilibrium, because otherwise it's easy to do it. So it's hard to reconcile both.
Well, the theories could just be wrong.
Yeah. I think most of the times the equilibrium assumption is based on convenience, not on real evidence. Which makes sense to some extent. I'll keep going. You're probably. So, okay, this is. I was saying we have to decide which of the microstates are going to drive transcription. This is sort of arbitrary. So we have taken the approach of trying different options and see if the conclusions are the same. So we have these gene regulation strategies we call. So this all or nothing strategy, where you only have, so these numbers are the weight on expression of the different states. So in this case, you only have transcription when everything is bound. This one or more, each state that has something bound contributes with the same weight to transcription, and this average finding the weight and the contribution to transcription depends on the number of sites occupied. Mm-hmm. So we can go from just having probability to having expression as a function of the case, these coproductivities and transcription function contribution. Okay, this is technicality. It will be clear in a moment why I'm defining this. So the main goal is we don't want to feed the model to data. So we want to explore how the model behaves in a general way. And to do so, we define these two quantities. So usually our expression in our model expression looks like it's a sigmoidal curve, basically. And what we have done is we have characterized the sigmoidal by two quantities. The stiffness, which is the maximum derivative, and the position, which is the normalized differential factor concentration for which we find the maximum derivative. And as a reference to know where our model is, we have the hill function, which is believed to be And again, this expression given by the hill function, and we can extract from here, we can extract analytical expressions for the stiffness and for the position. So why I'm doing this? So given our model, we can give random values to the k's and the omegas, and it will give rise to a specific sigmoidal. And you'll have
the position is related to half expression and it's normalized to half.
No, really. So if we go here, did you see that the Hill function has a 1 here? Even if you have a 1 here, so this means that this guy's normalized on invasion. So it's normalized by half maximum. But still, the position where the maximum derivative of this expression happens also moves a little bit. So we are normalizing everything by half expression, also in our model. So I have TF concentration here to make things in growth.
Just a simple question is how you normalize the TF axis is just a place where TF is 1 is half maximum expression or is the biggest?
Yeah, so we normalize it by the TF concentration where you find half expression.
Another question about experiments. I think the slide before you had this all or nothing, right, these different lookup, this thing, right? This, presumably in some systems now, we can actually test.
How?
You can knock out binding sites and knock them in, and then ask how this expression changes and knock them in.
Yeah.
So which one is true? I guess it depends on the system. It depends on the system, but the examples of all of them, I presume.
I don't know if you can find a single example where mutating a binding site completely disrupts.
So you're saying you wouldn't have that guy up there?
I don't think so.
But the other two, you can imagine that there's all sorts of things.
But it's difficult to characterize. Right. And also, it's not the same mutating this binding site here than this binding site.
Right.
The best attempt at that is probably the guy Woshu, Cohen, and there's a paper even with NCJ, which they made a whole library
precisely
of these. And then what they actually found was that thermodynamic model did quite well.
Did quite well.
Yeah. So that's the best, because it implies doing the kind of exercise you want. And, you know, the combinatorics is too big. I mean, nobody's going to make 200 flies. It's going to be hard to interpret. But in East, people did those library, and so that's probably the best reference to actually say that things maybe are not that far from equilibrium.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So given sigmoidal curve like that one there, we can basically project it into this stiffness position stress. And if we keep giving random values to the k's and the omegas, we have a small cloud of points. So what we have done is we have built an optimization algorithm that expands this region until it reaches a boundary. And the boundary represents, so the area inside the boundary is the area that can be reached by the model, no matter which parameters we give it. So in this way, we avoid feeding parameters, and we just look at extreme behaviors of the model. And so this is the kind of shapes I'm going to show you from the moment on. So I want to I want it to be clear. And another thing we are plotting here too is also the heel line. So the heel functions live along this line in this thinness position space. And crosses mark the integer values of the exponent. So our heel function doesn't have this half maximum TF concentration. The only parameter is the exponent. So when you vary it, you move along the heel line. And yeah, and this is the boundary we lack. And from this moment on, I'm just going to show you boundaries. So the first thing we explore with this is, okay, can pairwise covertivities explain what we observe? So we start with three binding sites, and this is the all or nothing strategy, because it's the one that is closest to the Hill functions form if you look at the equation. So for three binding sites, if we only allow pairwise covertivities, we see that our system gets stuck. So it can only get close to the Hill function 22, not 3.
So what defines the boundary?
So the boundary is something. Okay, let's go back. So we have our equation. If we get random values here, you can imagine if you get infinite random values, you won't plan anywhere in space. There's a confinement of your equation. So what we do is we find that boundary. We find the boundary that defines the space in Stevenson position where our model lives.
Well, what's the condition for the boundary?
There's no condition. So if I keep, so what I do is I start with a cloud of points, random. I find the points in the boundary. I mutate the parameters a little bit for those points in the boundary, and if I'm lucky, some of the new points will lie outside of that boundary. And I keep doing that again and again. And at some point, I reach a boundary that can't be overcome. If I run this optimization algorithm for 3 weeks, I won't overcome the boundary. So
I have an idea what sets the position. But do you have an idea what sets the constraints of the edges? It's just some of the, okay, you said some of these are the Hill functions, but how about the other ones? Is there a constraint? It seems to be to be a sharp edge, so why can't you go over it?
Here?
On either of these?
I mean, I don't get the...
Maybe we just lost track of what's being optimized? So model, you said
forget about the model.
You can optimize something.
Just
so
think
you
about
optimize
function.
Some fit, or
yeah, think about this function.
And you look at the stiffness. So yeah. You normalize it, I suppose.
So imagine you have this function which has this shape.
Yeah.
I define two properties of function: position and stiffness.
Yeah.
So given a random set of parameters for this k and this omega, this is the x-axis here. I can create a cloud of points in this position stiffness space, right?
But surely I can make the curve arbitrarily steep.
No, you cannot.
I can't. I'm missing something. Why can't I?
You can.
So are there logarithms here, or?
It's just polynomials of the polynomials.
Okay.
You can be arbitrarily steep with a specific function. There's a limit to the students. We can discuss this later. I can show you the equations.
Thank you.
I think it's a bit also has to do with the normalization, how you normalize things.
Are there logarithms involved in this? I don't understand how I can't be arbitrarily steep. Right? All I do is rescale the horizontal axis.
But this is normalization. Yeah, so that's why I'm normalizing. So yeah, this is when I say TF here, I'm saying TF over TF maximum. Or TF half maximum, which is normalizing.
So really this
which
is
a parameter. Okay. I'm just lost.
Okay,
go on.
We can discuss later. I can show you the details of this.
Is the number of binding sites fixed?
Yeah, so this example I'm showing you is for a fixed number of binding sites. That's
so
something that's
what
fixed.
Is that number?
I'm going to show you different examples.
For
this one, it's 5. But I'm going to go back to this shape later.
Okay.
Maybe let me say pairwise, I'm a bit lost because it seems you do pairwise in the cooperativity, not in the energy. So you, as Boris said, there is an exponential. So even if you have pairwise in the energy, you can have a lot when you look at the probability.
If you have pairwise
in the energy. If you just say that there is an energy that has pairwise interaction, then when you look at if you do the exponential, then you have the impression that you would have interaction between them.
But those exponentials are just... So your polynomial, the equation is not an exponential. The equation is a polynomial or a polynomial, and the coefficients of the polynomial are related to those exponentials you're showing. So in the end, your exponentials are just numbers. It doesn't matter how big those numbers are, you can't overcome the other because it's the range of the okay. So restricting to pairwise cooperativity, so one-to-one interaction. What I find is with three binding sites, your Hill function is here. So given the initial hypothesis, which is a Hill function, explains like three binding sites binding at equilibrium and acting cooperatively in a pure manner can be explained by the Hill function of exponent 3. What I find is that if you do the modeling right, your equation lives only in this area here and never reaches the Hill function exponent 3. I can keep adding sites and see whether I get closer and closer to what I expect. So with 4 sites, I will expect to be here, but I'm still stuck there. If I keep adding sites, my shape keeps increasing, but even with up to 12 sites, I never reach not even a Hill function exponent 5. And this is with pairwise cooperativity only.
So I would be though very careful in saying that you need to get to 5, right? I mean, what Bing was being measuring when you're computing are two very different things. Yeah? Is you are looking, I mean, the 5, at least if it's from Thomas Kramer's paper, is a protein to protein, right? You are looking probability of activating a gene. You're making RNA. This RNA is actually constant, I believe, to be stable. So there is a lot of the NS2 data, I don't know, do they show any of
the NS2 data, you get Hill exponent of 5.
Can you see that?
If NS2, yeah. Yeah. I know this data from Thomas and they take it. So the next thing we can do
is... when I'm not put it, you also get a mess, right? It's a lot more noisy and all the nuclei fire.
It's noisy, of course.
No, but it's noisy to the point that one nucleus fire and the other one doesn't. Next to it, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And that's what if you get the minimum promoter. I mean, I'm just saying, it seems to me that the fact that you don't get to 5 doesn't bother me. It is a lot more complicated than just a simple answer with binding.
But what I'm saying, so just think about the theory and the way things are stated. The usual statement is if I go and I make an experiment, I feed it, it looks like a sigmoidal, so the first thing I do is feed it to a Hill function. I feed it to a Hill function of exponent n. It's a very common statement saying, oh, that's probably caused by n sites being occupied cooperatively by
two people still make. I mean, I thought
yes.
Everybody was aware that that's not the case. I mean, at least the people I talked to, I mean, nobody would make this statement. I mean, everybody knows that that's kind of an extreme limit, and it's not normally the case. I mean, it's not even the case right in hemoglobin, if you measure, you don't get 4.
Yeah.
Everybody, you get 2.8, right? And everybody knows that people have this permission for that. So I don't know, I feel it's a bit of an extreme to say that all biologists will say that.
No, I don't say all biologists will say that, but it's something you still see in newly published papers.
Okay.
Like protein for foliation. We feed this thing to a Hill function exponent 23. which means there are 23 phosphorylation sites. This happens. So, okay, so going back to this, here is only perverse copertivity. What happens if we allow this higher copertivity? So, many multiple transcription factors helping an extra transcription factor to bind. Mm-hmm. And this, again, this is the shape I was showing you before. This is the model for 5 binding sites. And this, again, this all or nothing strategy. Trust you only when everything's bound. What I find is this is the boundary of the model. So the model lives here and only approaches the Hill function exponent 5, which is exactly the same number of sites, in a very extreme case. And when we look at the parameters at the point which is closest to the Hill function, and specifically when we look at the copertivities, what we find is this profile here. So I'm going to explain to you. Each of these bars is the value of
identical
one
binding sites. Identical in terms of their energetic.
They are all identical.
Five binding sites.
Identical, and there's nothing promoting like cooperativities of sites that are far away are the same. There's no spatial information. So each of these bars is a cooperativity system. There are a lot of them. And the ones on the left, the ones here, are the previous cooperativities. These ones are the higher order cooperativities with increasing order. And so this is 0. And this is 1. And so bars going down are, if you remember, the affinity was scaled by multiplying the affinity to DNA by the cooperativity. So a cooperativity smaller than 1 is basically decreasing the affinity of the next transcription factor. And bigger than 1 is increasing it. So what we find is that to be here, most of the perverse cooperativities have to be negative in the sense that not promoting at all the binding of new transcription factors. And then also most of the higher cooperativities, except for the highest order ones, which are basically those that describe when you already have 4 binding sites occupied, how they together promote the binding of an extra, of the 5th site to transfusion. And okay, so it seems that with 5 binding sites, if you are willing to assume that this cooperative profile is reasonable, you can reach a Hill function exponent 5. However, it seems unlikely because first, for these cooperativities to be at play, you need to start filling your enhancer first. But if you never promote the binding of consecutive sites, you'll never make it here. And this is something we see for this or nothing strategy. If we go to the other strategies, so this all of these one or more where all the sites contribute with the same weight, the shape is different, but this tip is the same. So we still see this tip. And the same thing happens with the average finding.
Quick question. So what if on-off isn't like the same all the time? So what if you could be technically off the binding site but still local, so then you're more easily re-recruited compared to something that's truly, truly off?
Again.
So you're assuming that the transcription factor is either on or off the binding site?
No, they have an affinity. So there's these dynamics of binding and unbinding, which is equilibrium. I'm not assuming on-off. It's not binary.
Okay.
So there's a K. There's an affinity constant, like a typical ligand receptor reaction.
And to get this peak to be at 5 in the 1 or more or average binding, do you need higher order?
Yes.
So
profile
for all of them, you need higher order cooperativity.
Yes.
Which is your point. Pairwise is not enough.
Pairwise is not enough at all. I show you the pairwise cooperativity diagram I show you. It was for the all or nothing strategy. I didn't show you these other strategies because the area you get is so small that it's not. So here I want to get back to the gene regulation methods of the study. So if we were to compare how eukaryotes regulate transcription versus how prokaryotes do it, they do it in a very different way. So we know that in bacteria, transcription factors, so the average transcription factor binding site is around 16 base pairs, and this binding is very strong. And usually, promoters have around one or two binding sites for transcription factor, so, and there's this ferrous covertivity. And from these studies in bacteria is where people started to build up these equilibrium-based models. And they work pretty well in bacteria, although if someone here is working bacteria, I will say that there's still many things we don't know, but they work pretty well in bacteria. And from there, they have been started to be applied in eukaryotes, yeast, and flies, and so on. However, so if we look at how genes are regulated in eukaryotes, binding sites are way smaller, and they are degenerate, meaning that transcription factor can bind to different DNA sequences, and the binding is weak. Also, we have many transcription factor binding sites to regulate a single gene, and this binding happens covertively, but there are also these other molecules that bind both to DNA and transcription factors, molecules like mediator, which are these huge complexes that are also influencing binding of everything here. And also, again, we have the chromatin that has to be remodeled and moved around to open up spaces. And this process, many different patients, requires ATP. So this here totally breaks the hypothesis of things that are happening at equilibrium. What if they are not happening at equilibrium at all? So that's what we have explored too. So going back to our diagram, if we don't do that step of inputting data imbalance, what we have is our expression depends on our forward and reverse reactions. They are all independent, they can do whatever they want. And of course, transcription factor concentration again. So we know how to calculate the probability of these states analytically for this graph out of equilibrium. And the reference on how we're doing it is here. And so what happens when we depart from equilibrium? So things get really messy. So for three binding sites, at equilibrium we have 7 parameters, including the affinities to DNA. Away from equilibrium, we have 24. But the number of parameters is not only, we find we have 50 and 160, which is crazy too, but the problem is not the number of parameters, but it's the expression, so the equation itself. So for three binding sites, the equation away from equilibrium is this. It's insane. And this means that we are doing everything analytically, so we can technically, we can't go beyond three sites. I mean, I ran Mathematica for a week to try to get the equation for 4+4 sites, and you never get them. And that's because in away from equilibrium, you have history dependence. So you have to calculate the probability of getting to one state from all the possible paths along your graph. And that's really messy. And the number of paths increases really fast when you increase the number of sites. Okay, we are stuck with three sites now. We are working on numerical methods to try to go beyond three sites. But we can do the same thing we did before with three sites. So this is the same shape I showed you before for three sites, for five sites, but for three. So again, you approach the limit of the Hill function exponent 3 just at the tip of the cusp. This is at equilibrium. If we now depart from equilibrium, what we see is that our boundary increases by a lot. And the same thing happens, this for the all or nothing strategy, the same thing happens for the one or the average binding strategy. So it seems like departing from equilibrium truly allows you to overcome the Hill limit for a given number of sites. So the take home here is probably that the bacterial paradigm seems insufficient to explain some features of genetic revolution in eukaryotes. I won't say all, but at least it seems like explaining using the bacterial paradigm this sharp transition of hands back to Bicoid is not right. And if one wants to explain it at equilibrium, at least has to assume that hierarchical recovery is at play. And probably, I will say, this is more like it's more an opinion, but I think the profile of convergence is crazy. And out of equilibrium boosts the range of possible behaviors and might be a good explanation to why we are getting this shape here. So next things we are doing, we have this, I show you these different, these three different genetic regulation strategies like all or nothing, one or more. So what we're doing is we are modifying the model to include polymerase. So you can imagine in the graph, one of the sites where cryovectors were binding, now it's dedicated to polymerase to bind. So here we can just say that the probability of having transcription is probability of the states that have polymerase found. And so when we do that, this is for six sites, we get a different shape, but again, we still have the limit. So conclusions hold, we're good. And also, one will say, okay, we are always comparing to the Hill limit. Where do real embryos live in these positions in this space? And this is preliminary, and the data is, like, we are still not sure if the data is clean enough, and is really variable, but it seems like I tried to plot a bunch of embryos and they live around here, although I get some embryos here, I didn't plot them, so we are working on that. And this data is collected by GiHipark.
So what embryos only have this is a bunch of genes that are expressed in this pattern. So where do you get the... Well,
so this is Bicoid, hunchback response to Bicoid. A P2 enhancer of hunchback in a reported construct and have a response to Bicoid. And
so this is just, you get the cloud because you do it for many embryos and each one is a little different.
Yeah, and also it depends on where you look in a single embryo, there's variability and the variability is very big. So we are still, this is like super preliminary. I was wondering, like, what happens if I get an embryo and I can measure it properly and I know that there is no error and my embryos live here? And even if I increase the number of sites, like, let's say that there are not only six sites, but there are eight sites, but still they live here. Can I say that this, I'm proving that the system is working away from equilibrium? I don't know. I think it's a very extreme statement. It looks like, but I think it's too extreme too.
And so for these data, you're going to take the endogenous, you're going to take three Bicoid binding sites from the endogenous hunchback enhancer, or you're going to construct an enhancer that contains no information except the three binding sites?
So we are doing, this data is shown here. So hunchback is regulated by three enhancers.
Exactly.
We took the P2 enhancer, which is the one believed to be driving this transcription, and in any case, is the one that gives rise to a Hill function X1 and 5. And we put in a reported construct to measure. We have tried also removing sites. This all this has been done by GiHipark. She's writing the paper now. And so we try removing sites and see how that affects the Hill exponent. It doesn't affect that much. Of course, not as much as expected. And we also have this tool we call SiteOut that we can use to build basically neutral sequences, sequences of DNA where devoid of the binding sites we want. So we are using it in the lab a lot to build synthetic enhancers. So you can take the hunchback enhancer with its individual binding site and replace everything that's in between binding sites by something that's neutral. So no height back binds there, but either like no decoy binds there, but also no height back, no Eve, no other regulators that you might think might be interfering. And we get also a very sharp response out of it.
And these embryos with these different constructs, they also have their endogenous hunchback promoter intact.
Yes.
Okay.
We are also trying to implement CRISPR in the lab in general for differentiation. And finally, another thing I'm trying to address now is the sequence variability problem. So we have a model that might be able to describe very well, although it's not the case, but it might be able to describe data we have for Drosophila melanogaster. So here, this is the P2 enhancer with a very low threshold for transcription factor binding site identification, so that's why there are no six, but more. And so this is for Drosophila melanogaster, and these are other Drosophila species. And this is the same enhancer. And as you see, there's loss of binding sites, there's binding site rearrangement, and still when we go to the, when we measure the response of hunchback, it doesn't seem to be that different. Again, this is preliminary, this is work in progress, but I would like to somehow address how can the model accommodate these changes in sequence while you retain your function.
One way to get a sharp response is just to replace a thing that the transcription factor is sequestered.
Yeah, this we are also thinking about that, like maybe the decoy profile is not the decoy profile. You're measuring probability that maybe the available decoy to bind to the promoter or to the enhancer is not that. So that's another thing we are exploring together with Hernan. He's doing experiments. So with this, I just want to acknowledge my lab in the fancy everyday outfit, and also Jeremy and Felix, who was working the project, and Kate and Hugh were rotation students working with the polymerase model modifying. And thank you.